Welcome to the Applied Policy Podcast, featuring highlights from a recently convened Northern Virginia Health Policy Forum.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us for this month's Northern Virginia Health Policy Forum, entitled A Fireside Chat on the Pharmaceutical Supply Chain. My name is Linda O'Neill. I'm the Vice President of Health Policy here at Applied Policy. We are a small health policy and reimbursement consulting firm in Alexandria, Virginia. We are actually thrilled to have the panel and the topic of discussion that we've got for you today. Supply chain disruptions continue to be an issue and a concern for many, as they have a significant impact sometimes on the availability of key pharmaceuticals for healthcare providers and the patients they serve. We have a fantastic panel for you today, several who I've known for a long time and are experts in their field. They're incredible leaders and they have busy schedules, so we're thrilled they're able to spend some time with us today talking about the pressures that the supply chain faces, how to increase resiliency going forward, and what can be done to avoid shortages as much as possible in the future. So with that, please join me in welcoming Dr. Nicolette Louisant, who is the Chief Policy Officer at the Healthcare Distribution Alliance, Craig Burton, who is Senior Vice President of Policy and Strategic Alliances for the Association for Accessible Medicines, and Tom Cross, who's the Vice President of Government Relations at the American Society of Health System Pharmacists. Thank you all for joining us today, and let's just get right into the topic. This first question is easy. I'm going to just ask each one of you to, I already introduced you and your associations, but if you could talk a little bit more about your role, a little bit more about your experience, and a little bit about where your organization fits into the supply chain, I think that will help tee up the discussion nicely. And so Craig, maybe from that manufacturer perspective, I'll have you start.
Thanks, Linda. Glad to join you guys. As Linda said, I'm Craig Burton, Senior Vice President for Policy and Alliances here at AAM. Been here about 8 years. So for those who don't know AAM, we are the trade association representing generic and biosimilar manufacturers. These are the products that are not driving high prices for patients and payers. They are comprising about nine of every 10 prescriptions filled, but only about 13% of costs. What that means as you think about these issues is that the shortage issues, if not limited to generics, are certainly focused among generics. And there are a lot of reasons that we can talk about, but I think the common refrain as you look at the story of shortages today and over the years is that there is almost always a financial element to that. If you look at the rates, some work we did with the IQVIA Institute that we published about a year and a half ago, found that the overwhelming majority of products that are in drug shortages these days are not only generics, but have unit costs of less than $5. When you narrow into generics that are in shortage, it's something like 70% roughly are products with low unit costs. So there is almost always a financial element. These are older products where the price has been driven down to a level that is challenging to maintain. And then all it takes is something, whether it's a bankruptcy, whether it's a natural disaster, whether it's an inspection gone wrong, it just takes that one little tipping point to move into a shortage or a supply disruption.
I think we will definitely get into some of the solutions. And I love that you teed up a little bit of the ripple effect, because I think that we will also be digging into that. We are a very interconnected supply chain. And as you said, one little thing can have an impact across the entire supply chain, and obviously to the patients that are the end users of those pharmaceuticals. So Nicolette, moving on to you, just a little bit more about your role, a little bit more about HDA's and your perspective. Thanks.
Sure. First, thank you for having me. Always nice to hang out with friends for an hour. So much easier to go after Craig, because I agree with a lot of the way that he laid it out. So, Nicolette Lewis-Saint, Chief Policy Officer for the Healthcare Distribution Alliance. HDA is one of the nation's oldest trade associations. We are 149 years old, which speaks to how long wholesalers have been a part of the supply chain and have played a role in the movement of products across the United States. I think it's important to note that when we talk about different components of the supply chain and the complexity of the supply chain, when you really think about the numbers that go into that, I think it puts a little bit more color onto why the supply chain works the way that it does. When you have 1,200 manufacturers that are connecting to almost 40 distributor members that are our members, that are then moving out to 300,000 plus sites of care, those products have to move every day. And the work that distributors do means that an order that's placed by 4 p.m. that evening will be on the doorstep at 8 a.m. the next morning. And so what we take for granted, I think, in this country is that when we place an order or when we get a prescription from our doctor, that we'll be able to pop over to our local CVS or Walgreens or to our independent pharmacy, and that can be filled same day or next day. And so that's really what distributors play a role in doing, is that movement, the logistics of moving products. And that's why shortages are so important to us, because we are often the first call that is made when there is a shortage or when a pharmacy realizes that there's a problem. Their distributor is often that first call. I agree with a lot of what Craig has said. One thing that I often think is important to note is that if you've seen one shortage, you've seen one shortage. And a lot of times, the effort to oversimplify the dynamics of shortages do not give credence to the fact that in such a highly complicated system, there may be individual variables from the supply side or the demand side that really create the constraints that we see that result in shortages. Spot shortages are not uncommon. There may be small disruptions that happen, and I think that should be reserved for a separate conversation. I think a lot of this is really about long-term shortages and understanding the drivers of those. I agree with Craig. I think we have valued the generics market, and we've valued for the last 40 years driving down the cost of meds. But I think there are cases where, and wholesalers agree, for the price of a generic, the price may be too low. So I think that's a big part of what we need to consider is, are there dynamics that have driven down the cost of meds, but in some instances, driven down the cost of meds to a place where it's not sustainable? Also, have we created enough buffer in the system so that as everyone is thinking about what is possible upstream and what even the wholesalers are able to hold, have we created enough buffer so that even our provider partners at the facility level are holding enough products so that we can be able to, quickly respond, but also have enough buffer so that in that response, we're not seeing shortages continue? So I think there's a lot to think through. I think there are many different pieces, but I do think there may be some strategies that we often talk about as mitigation that are in one bucket versus the long-term addressing of drug shortages, which will require some significant policy change.
All great points. It's been perfect follow-up. And then Tom.
Thank you. So I'm Tom Kraus. So ASHP represents pharmacists who work in hospital and health system settings, as well as ambulatory clinical settings, and our members also operate several thousand community pharmacies. So we're kind of at the tail end of this supply chain, and one of the things that we do is track where we're experiencing shortages at the bedside. And so at any given moment, we're tracking right now about 270 shortages. You'll notice that that number is substantially higher than the number that's reported by FDA. And it's because of some of those kind of individualized distribution challenges that Nicolette was mentioning. But from our perspective, if we can't get access to the product at the bedside, that's a problem for patient care. Something like a third of our members report having had to delay or cancel therapies because of a given drug shortage. We also tend to be heavily impacted by what are called sterile injectable shortages. So Craig mentioned that generics are most likely to be the drugs that are in shortage, and about half shortages are generic sterile injectables. So those are these sterile products, often very low-cost products that are injected or infused for patient care during a given procedure. And a lot of those get used in hospital and ambulatory settings. So that can be very disruptive for patient care. You know, our members often are trying to figure out, working with physicians, is there an alternative therapy? Are there, you know, what can we do as a first, second, third line choice to get this patient the best care possible, given the access to medications? I agree with a lot of what Craig and Nicolette said around the impact of economics and some potential mitigation. So I'm looking forward to having those conversations. There's a lot of opportunity for us to address this.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, guys, for all the background. And I think sharing the perspectives from the different aspects of the supply chain. And again, I think that's going to be a really robust discussion because we've got all of you here on one panel. And Tom, you kind of started teeing up some of the topics. So let's get into some of the issues. You guys kind of all hinted at this, but maybe for the first question, I'm going to go in the same order. So Craig, this will come to you first, is let's go a little deeper. We've talked about that there are shortages and we've talked about disruptions, but could you go a little bit deeper from your perspective, the manufacturer's perspective, on why these issues occur in general? I know there's lots of reasons. You've seen one shortage, but from a big picture perspective, get some thoughts on why these issues occur and maybe what is then that ripple effect impact on your trading partners?
What I would suggest here, you know, both Nicolette and Tom raised a really important point. There are different types of shortages. So as a starting place, I'm going to comment more on those shortages where a manufacturer knows it's having issues, it's made that report to the FDA. That is a different issue. The issues there are different than when there is a supply disruption and there is product, say, in New Jersey, but not in New Mexico, right? So both have an equally challenging impact on patient care, but the causes and therefore the solutions are going to be different. So it's important to be clear what we're talking about. So as I mentioned, you know, the core, you know, for generics and you know, a generics shortage is very different than, say, the shortages we've seen in a certain brand market that has been demand driven. These are older products. These are products that have been on the market for years where the price has been driven down over time. As a result, the market has consolidated. You may have 10 or more manufacturers with approvals to manufacture that product, but only one or two or three actually in the business of producing and marketing that product. You know, what that means is then when the proximate cause may differ, right? If you look back at the last couple of years, there have been shortages tied to a US-based company declaring bankruptcy and shutting down their operations. There have been shortages tied to tornadoes, hurricanes hitting North Carolina. And then there have been shortages tied to a company having a bad inspection and having to pause their operations, right? All of those proximate causes are going to be different, but the impact to the patient is equally harmful. And in those instances, because you have a market that's been reduced to two or three, maybe four manufacturers at the most, you know, that's not something that other generic manufacturers can just flip a switch and ramp up to fill that gap overnight. Now, can it be done? Sure. But that line, that space on a manufacturing line is largely spoken for. That's committed a number of months out. So if you're gonna try to repurpose a line to ramp up production of a cancer product, for instance, great. You're gonna have to acquire the API, you're gonna have to bump something else. We're going to realize we need to do this on a Wednesday and we're going to have it by Friday conversation. I think those are all challenges. I think, you know, one of the, you know, that the impact on the supply chain is, you know, has been spoken to by Nicolette and Tom. And I think one of the issues you run into here is you have a healthcare system that pays, that encourages and pays based on kind of a just-in-time inventory approach that does not reward providers for holding buffer supply, Nicolette mentioned, right? That that does not reward providers for perhaps investing in a longer term fixed price, fixed volume type of contract, but that rewards them when they consistently seek out the lowest priced option out there. That in turn affects the ability of generic manufacturers to invest in new capacity if they don't know what their market is going to be day to day.
That's a great way to tease some of it. And I think that's a way you framed up to the, we only have two or three manufacturers, right? And the it's hard for, if you're not in that business and the supply chain, to really understand what that means in terms of you only got one or two, right? A manufacturer is doing that particular product and one goes down for whatever reason, you've got a real problem on your hands. And it's not that quick to just flip the switch, as you said. Nicolette, thoughts from your perspective on some of the reasons that we've got some of the shortages and disruptions that we do.
I'll just build off of what Craig said. I think it's important to note that when we look at the two drug shortages lists, I think Tom was speaking to that kind of spot shortage dynamic. And I think one of the realities is that the lack of incentives to hold more product mean that a facility is really going to be at any point in time, if we're lucky, 48 hours away from needing a product to be replenished. And so some of those instances are, there's just a rigidity downstream that means that if a product cannot be delivered, say for a hurricane, or there is an upstream challenge, or there's just a delay, a lag of getting things through the system, that is going to create that spot instance, right? And I think that can amplify to a sustained shortage, because that means that rigidity that exists downstream makes it very difficult for a system to be able to adjust. To Craig's point, though, we're not incentivizing the system to hold more product at any point in the supply chain. Without being redundant, I think it's important to think about how we are able to pivot and react. But I think it's also important for us to touch on what happens in instances of surge, because there are these shortages that are created because there may be medical surge. And so a lot of what we talk about tends to be upstream supply-driven challenges, but there are these demand-driven challenges that, you know, it can be Ozempic and Wegovy, sure, but it could also be doxycycline. It could also be, you know, some other very run-of-the-mill IV saline, right? Like things that we take for granted that, you know, are in abundance, but in an instance of a disease outbreak or a seasonal fluctuation, a very bad flu season, or some sort of regional dynamics, regional event could be in demand. And typically what's required is then the distributors have to then, if it's a regional event, they have to shift resources that are available nationally to be able to address this regional need. But that also then means that if you're in a situation where you see this demand shortage at the national level, the triple-demic, as an example, we saw that a couple of years ago, there isn't enough product to shift because the demand is everywhere. But that also means that when you start to see these upticks, that some of our well-meaning downstream partners may purchase more than they actually need. And one of our partners who's now retired used to refer to it as overbuying, which I just think is hilarious and I will never forget. But thinking about it as purchasing more than is actually needed in that instance, because there is this overall demand shift, and that creates further strain on the system. And so those are things that we do see, and they happen in regular order. Something that we think about a lot is reverse distribution. Sometimes when those things are purchased and overbought, and then no longer needed, they flow back into the system. But the reality is that that can cause some very significant disruptions in the supply chain and can make a shortage far more severe and far more acute for a short amount of time, because that's the system is grappling with a number of entities buying more than is actually needed and more than their historical picture in real time.
That's a great point, right? Shortages and disruptions can come from both supply issues or demand issues. It can come from either end of the spectrum on that. So, Tom?
Yeah, let me just build on a couple of these points. So one, with regard to Craig's point around generics and kind of the incentives there, the economics there. So He mentioned the difference between generic and branded manufacturers. And I just want to put a finer point on that, which is to say, just really bluntly, if you are making a branded GLP-1, you have a multi-billion dollar incentive to fix any of your own supply chain challenges, to get additional capacity online, have redundant capacity. Like, those are dollars waiting for you, right? If you are a generic manufacturer, when you have a supply chain disruption or you have an issue at a facility, you're talking about the prospect in some cases of manufacturing a product that loses money or it has a very, very thin margin. And so, like, investing in kind of big capital expenditures, that is a challenge. And it might make more sense for you to stop manufacturing that product and shift to another product, over a multi-month or multi-year period that is more lucrative. That is a totally reasonable business decision for someone to make. But I just want folks to understand, because the economics between brands and generics is so different, it makes sense for folks to make those kind of decisions. I don't know, Greg, if that's a fair description.
Yeah, no, I think that's exact. I mean, one way to think about it, if you think about a large company, for instance, selling a GLP-1, they're managing a brand, they're managing a market. Whereas by comparison, a generic company is almost liken it to managing your investment portfolio, where you're trying to manage your and make sure you have the right exposure in this market, in this market, in this market, in this market. And a generic manufacturer is trying to have that right product mix to meet the demands of Nicolette's members and meet the demands of your members while still making the math work financially. So no, I think that's exactly a great way to speak to it.
The other thing that I just want to mention is with regard to kind of purchasing practices, it is absolutely true that in most cases, purchasers, the end users, providers, hospitals, are largely going to make purchasing decisions on price. We would like to have more visibility into manufacturing, supply chain, and practices to know if we're going to pay a premium for products or a premium for a relationship with a given manufacturer, that comes with some level of certainty around the reliability of that manufacturer. Now, there's a lot of discussion to be had around how do you structure that effectively? What's the right level of transparency and for whom? The point is, at the end of the day, these drugs are a cost for us. And so it is true that we purchase based on price. We would like to have a situation where we are better able to make purchasing decisions on some aspect of reliability. And Craig was mentioning we were kind of getting into some potential solutions, kind of circling around this, concepts around long-term purchasing agreements. And Nicolette was mentioning, carrying extra inventory. Both of those are kind of potential solutions, that one that kind of addresses this economic challenge and one that is a shorter term mitigation.
So I want to jump in with two, I would say, refinements. One, I totally agree with the characterization of kind of the branded companies and the generic companies. And I think that's a really important driver. There's also a third company that we don't often talk about, the companies that have brands and generics. Mm-hmm. And they are balancing that portfolio, as Craig described, understanding that for some of those generic products, in some instances, the generic sterile injectables, the GSIs that I'm sure we'll talk about, those products are done in the red. They are not necessarily making money on those products, but there are other parts of their portfolio that offset those expenditures, right? So I think oftentimes folks that are not steeped in this space think about it as they're brand companies that only do brands and they're generic companies that only do generics. But there's a nuanced story there. Then when we think about how they're balancing that portfolio, have to appreciate that there are many instances where a manufacturer is operating in the red on a product line, understanding that if they leave that market, that they will create constraints in that market. So I just refinement number one. Refinement number two is, and I think it's important to distinguish when we're thinking about purchasing practices, there are differences in different facility types, right? And so hospitals and health systems being different, for example, than pharmacies being different than the clinic space. Oftentimes, there is a lot of information that is available as it relates to measures of reliability, how that information is factored in, how that information is available, who sees that information, I think are all things that we can debate and who should see the information. These guys know I feel very strongly about. But I think that that information can be available. But I think there's also a couple of things to consider. One is no one, including the manufacturers, benefit from a shortage. So fundamentally, there is an implicit incentive in avoiding a shortage because money is not made if contracts cannot be met because product is not available. So I think that's important. So when we're thinking about how to factor in additional measures of reliability, and I frame them as additional, I think it's important to couch it from a frame of how do we do that in a way that does not further penalize companies that are operating in that red environment or that limited environment? Because if we're not careful, we can actually create the opposite of the intended reaction and create more shortages rather than trying to alleviate them with those measures.
Yeah, we certainly don't want people to leave the market, right? In terms
Right.
of being able to,
Right.
yeah,
Let me
or
add,
lose market
Amanda,
share.
can I
Yeah.
add one more wrinkle to Nicolette's wrinkle?
Absolutely.
So not only are they, they're trying to balance their winners and losers, right? They're also balancing where they're selling. And it should not be lost on folks that a lot of the products that are in shortage in the US are not in shortage in Canada or in the EU. Manufacturers, this is a global market. Manufacturers have an obligation to go where they're able to have a sustainable market and have a sustainable price. And I mean, we have companies whose own leadership in the US hasn't been able to get the product that they manufacture because it's in shortage in the US, but they're selling it in the EU or in Canada. And that is, there's been a lot of attention paid recently to the fact, the argument that we're paying, higher prices for brand drugs than we are anywhere else in the world. And there's probably some truth to that. But there's undoubtedly truth that we are paying lower prices for generics than are being paid anywhere else in the world. And that kind of flows into, I think, you with all of this, you have to think about the incentives, right? I think this is the point Nicolette's making, this point Tom's making. You have to figure out the incentives for manufacturers, for wholesalers, for buyers and for different types of buyers. The overbuying dynamic that Nicolette mentioned is very real, and it hurts. Not only does it hurt providers because it can create shortages where there is none, it can hurt less sophisticated providers who don't have a dedicated supply chain person who's sitting around ready to hit buy at breaking news of a hurricane, right? But it also, one would think, well, they're buying up all the product. That helps the manufacturers. Not so fast here. Manufacturers have to, Nicolette talked about, if they don't use all that, does that flow back into the system? Well, maybe it flows back in the system. Maybe it gets returned to the manufacturer, and the manufacturer has to then eat that cost, which again is one more factor that a manufacturer is going to think very hard about whether they stay in that market in the future.
I just want to
Feel like, oh, go ahead, Tom.
I just want to add remind folks that are listening of the context here. I mean, we're kind of talking about some nuances and kind of challenges. I don't want folks to think that this is like a quirky corner of the healthcare marketplace. Remember, the drugs that Craig is talking about are 90% of the drugs that Americans use. So, like, this is the bulk of the drugs that people need to access. So just I don't want you to get lost in the
In the
details
minutia.
here and
Yeah.
think it's like something unique.
I love that we brought out the bigger picture of all the inputs and outputs that really have an impact on manufacturing decisions and where distribution fits in. And then from that provider perspective, right, there's a role and responsibility there too. It is very natural during a shortage or a pandemic or whatever it might be to overorder, as we kind of like to call it, because you don't ever want to not have enough to serve your patients in your community. That's a very hard dynamic to change and to influence. So I think how we've laid things out for the audience today really shines a lot of light on all the different things that go into that decision making and how pharmaceuticals are one made, but then two, how they're moving through the chain and how those disruptions are impacting them. So we've kind of talked about that from your own perspectives and where you are in the supply chain, but there's a lot of external, I don't mean natural disasters, but I'm thinking more external policies, and Craig touched on this a little bit in terms of other countries, but I feel like we'd be ignoring tariffs and trade policy if we didn't pull that into the conversation a little bit, because that does have an impact on decision making and the supply chain. It is a global chain, Craig, as you mentioned, and that impacts a lot of decisions that companies are making. And so, Nicolette, maybe I'll start with you on this one, but think about just from a big picture on tariffs and trade policies. We don't have to get down into the minutiae too much, because I know it's a little bit hard to know as it shifts and some of the headlines are a little bit different each day and where we think that might go. But give you a couple of thoughts on what that impact might have on the supply chain.
So I think oftentimes health policy conversations happen absent industrial policy considerations. But I think it is true that health policy is industrial policy. And so any policy that's going to shape markets and going to shape the industrial policy of the United States is going to immediately have impacts on various components of the supply chain that will result in changes in health policy. I think that fundamentally is true. When it comes to the current tariff and trade conversations, I think there are threads of health policy that are in there. There are also threads of national security policy that are in there. And those are threads that we've always appreciated that exist. So I'll just take the easier side. The national security side, I think, is important to consider when we're thinking through the strategic interests of the United States. And I think in the conversations about the strategic interests of the United States, tariffs have been used as a potential lever to drive certain national security outcomes. There can certainly be conversation about whether or not that is the best lever or the most effective. But I think that is one such lever that is trying to shift the conversation around the presence of pharmaceutical manufacturing and pharmaceutical supply chain capabilities in either the United States or allied nations to the United States, recognizing that there is a strategic risk to the United States if those manufacturing concentrations are elsewhere. But I think the other side of tariff policy that is important to note is that this type of industrial policy creates added burden, if we're not careful, on the same parts of the market that we just fully, you know, we spent 30 minutes characterizing the full breadth of the constraints that exist in that market. And so adding additional penalties or pain points that further deteriorate margin, that further add complexity to operations, will not actually enhance resilience. And I think that's the thing that we're trying to contend with, is there is a balance between that national security strategic interest and thinking about using tariffs as a potential lever to rehome or potentially increase geographic diversity. And I think there are ways that we can explore that. But I think fundamentally what we have to contend with is any industrial policy that is going to create additional burden or financial constraint on the upstream supply chain is going to have the potential to exacerbate the dynamics that Craig's already laid out, because manufacturers will be in a position where they're deciding, is it less expensive to add production capabilities in the United States or change their portfolio and focus on other markets that may be more profitable?
Great points. Tom, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, let me mention national security and then kind of tariffs. We agree from ESHP's perspective that we've actually for a long time had a position statement out there that there is a national security vulnerability because so much of our drug supply chain is sourced overseas, potentially from geopolitical adversaries. That said, tariffs may not be the solution to that if your goal, part of your goal, is to avoid a shortage, right? If you have a trade war that causes a shortage as opposed to a hot war, there's still shortages, and that's still still a vulnerability for our country. So we want to avoid that. Okay, so how can tariffs result in shortages? So there's kind of two main ways that I would encourage folks to think about. Number one is, Craig was already talking about kind of the economic challenges and the supply chain challenges. So when ingredients in those products or finished dosage of those products is subject to tariffs, that increases the cost of your inputs. And there's a good chance that if you are already operating on a razor thin margin, it just further increases the likelihood that there's a supply chain disruption, or you're no longer able to manufacture and sell that product profitably. And so that kind of accelerates the chances that someone makes a decision to drop out of that market. And in fact, in the United States, we have laws that in some circumstances prohibit you from increasing your drug prices faster than inflation. Otherwise, you pay a penalty. So now you end up in a situation where, okay, my cost just went up. I already have a razor thin margin, but if I increase my pricing, I'm going to have to pay a penalty to the government. I'm out of luck no matter what I do. And even if I wanted to increase domestic capacity, that's a multi-year undertaking and a capital intensive undertaking that I'll let Craig comment on. The other risk to tariffs is export controls. I mean, if a country said, okay, well, we're subject to a tariff, we're going to restrict access to a particular ingredient or particular feedstock, that would be very disruptive and could cause shortages, just like we've already seen China considering export restrictions around some rare earth minerals. So like those kinds of responses are totally possible in the drug space as well, and would result in shortages pretty quickly. So just keep those factors in mind.
I'm going to jump to Craig here, and then I'm going to give you kind of a heads up that like we've touched on a couple of questions I had teed out in terms of domestic production, and we've been talking about pricing quite a bit, which I think is really valuable and of interest to the audience. So Craig, I'm going to turn to you. And then I think what I may do is say, then let's talk about solutions and where you guys are all from an advocacy perspective going. So Craig, I want you to go on trade tariffs and that sort of thing. And then let's then think through about some solutions, and I'll probably have Tom go first on that one. So Craig.
Sounds good. I mean, I kind of feel like I could just say listen to what Nicolette and Tom just said, but I'll add a little bit to what they said. And I think what everyone's saying is that, look, in a perfect world, more domestic manufacturing is worthwhile. It is absolutely a laudable goal. I think it's very important to pursue that goal while understanding that domestic production, 100% domestic production, even if it were possible, is not necessarily the solution. There is no magical shield protecting production in the US from running into shortages. I mentioned, some of the biggest news drivers, shortage related, in the past couple of years have been related to production in the US. So that said, I think we all agree it is worth pursuing. How you pursue it is what's important. You run the risk, as Tom said, if you're already losing money on a product, or it's marginal as to whether you're able to stay in that market or not, and then you have a tariff dumped on the product and or the API used to produce the product, that may be the tipping point that where you just say, I can't absorb the cost. As Tom said, I can't pass on the cost. Federal law, Medicare law, in multiple instances through Medicare, Medicaid, through the reimbursement structure in Medicare Part A and B, really limits my ability to pass on the cost. So I either have to find a way to absorb the cost, and if I'm already at negative margins, that's going to be pretty difficult to do, or I have to get out of the market. right? So you want to avoid that. You need to think about, I mean, we have a significant base of unused capacity, unused manufacturing capacity in the US. So dig into why is that? What would it take to turn that back on? And here's a hint. Giving money to companies who've never produced a generic drug in their life is probably not the first step to effectively increasing the production in the US. Rather, I think I think there's a lesson from COVID that bears, which is investing in a resilient supply. That may be a combination of domestic production, strong relationships with trading partners. Right. I will remind people, and I periodically remind folks of this. In the early days of COVID, we were experiencing supply disruptions for certain products that were in high demand for in treating people when they had COVID. And if you listen to critics of the industry, we were going to have no product. No product was going to be available. But if you look at the story of those products, the industry made it work. They figured out a way to get product to patients. And you can track the order fulfillment rates for these products. And they dropped pretty quickly overnight in that February, March timeframe with the onset of COVID. And then within about a month, they increased actually to rates higher than historical norms for those products. You got there because you had a resilient supply chain. You had diverse manufacturing. You were not putting all your eggs in one basket. I think there's a lot there that you need to think about. We could absolutely go down a where's KSM and API manufactured route. That would take another hour. But that's another thing that folks need to think about. And then, when you think about why, look, there are some cost differences. If your cost of production in the US is going to be different than your cost of production in certain other locales, there are going to be environmental effects. These are all things that you need to think about as you're deciding how you want to pursue this goal.
I think that's a great way to tease some of those issues. You guys have done a phenomenal job really laying out all the levers around the supply chain and some of the internal and external forces, if you will, that cause disruptions with the ripple effect on everybody else. And we think there's been a lot of talk about domestic production being the answer and tying that in some ways to trade and tariffs, but not all. There's different aspects to some of those policies and why those are being pursued. So let's talk with a little bit with the time that we've left, right? You guys are all with national trade organizations, associations by their natures have an advocacy platform and policy solutions that they are looking to accomplish with policymakers. So share a little bit then with the audience and in the time that we have left. We think about everything we've talked about so far today. What are those top two or three policy solutions that your organizations are really pushing with, whether it's on Capitol Hill, whether it is with the administration, or even if it's at the state and local level? What are you looking to do that are around mitigation and supply chain resiliency and some of the solutions that are out there that will help reduce our shortages? Nicolette, why don't I start with you on that one?
I'm trying to be intentional about what I not overlapping with what I know Craig and Tom are going to say. So
You can say ditto if you needed to.
there, I think there's a lot of I joke, but I do think there's a lot of synergies in what we agree with. And I think fundamentally what we are looking for are policy solutions that are not going to impede the ability of the supply chain to do what it's currently doing well. Craig actually just touched on this, and I think it's a very important point to make. We have a very resilient supply chain, and HDA actually even has an AAR from COVID that talked about what we did well, what we were able to accomplish. It's important to note that the pharmaceutical supply chain largely stood up in COVID and did not break. And so it is important that policy solutions that we are putting forward do not impede the ability for the supply chain to continue to have those points of resilience. Again, I think looking at pricing barriers and really having conversations about some of the levers that have already been discussed is a really important part of our policy portfolio. Thinking about how dedicated and focused information sharing plays a role. that does not mean that everyone has information on everything, but that the right entities do have information that helps to make informed decisions. Also, to be able to detect quickly and respond rapidly to a pending shortage. But also, really looking at regulatory policy, that's been another place for us where we think there's an opportunity. There are a lot of ANDAs that are not currently in use, and thinking about are we approving too much? Are we thinking about how we are meaningfully approving generic products so that we are creating a more robust market? And then strategic incentives in domestic manufacturing. We are all for geographic resilience. We have concerns about rehoming of supply chains. We do not believe that production in the US means that it will inherently be high quality or resilient. And so thinking about how the federal government as a guaranteed purchaser can play a role in strategic incentives, thinking about the role of the DoD and the VA as guaranteed purchasers that could help to create incentives and sustain a market for domestic production. Those are some of the things that we're thinking about.
All great thoughts that really tie together some of the themes that have already come up in today's conversation. So appreciate all of that. Tom?
First of all, as Nicolette said, there actually is a lot of alignment here, and I think that's really positive. Like a few themes that folks can probably already pick up on: long-term contracting in a way that provides my members that are utilizing these drugs some level of greater certainty that they're actually going to be able to get the product when they need it, and provides Craig's members some greater level of certainty that if they commit to manufacturing a product, there's going to be a market for that product at the price that they're expecting. We agree that that would be very helpful. I think that should also be paired with some level of transparency so that my members know if they're in making a business relationship with a reliable manufacturer, but that's a detail that could be worked out. Some level of buffer supply in the system. Now, Nicolette, Craig, and I could argue about like where that supply should live in the system, but fundamentally, having supply in the system does give you a buffer so that when there's a manufacturing disruption, you know, there's product available. And then something around diversity of supply, not just having a single manufacturer that is just kind of undercut everyone else on price and they're the only one in the market, and if they have a disruption, we're sunk, right? Something that encourages multiple manufacturers in a sustainable way to stay in the market as a source of product.
You're right. You guys have a lot of synergy going here. Craig, are you going to keep it going, or are you going to throw something else onto the?
I'm going to throw something else on there
Okay, I
also.
love it. Let's go.
So I think those are absolutely all worthwhile. I also think we need to recognize that at best, those are going to be band-aids, right? We're trying, those are about mitigating, those are about reducing. I think the reality is the shortages we're seeing are a symptom of a market that currently is broken. The generic market is broken, and unless we address the broader sustainability of the generic market, we're gonna just be putting, run out of fingers and toes to stick into holes in the dam. You know, we need a generic market that is getting these products to market more quickly, that is getting them adopted more quickly. And one of the things we've not talked about, part of the pressure on these older low-priced products is that the adoption rate for new higher value products is slower than it has ever been. And that's because you have, and you let the record show, we went an hour before anyone said the word PBM. But that's because we have PBM practices that are driving adoption of brands for longer, even though they're lower priced generics on the market. Right. If a generic isn't making money on a newer high value product, that's going to put more pressure on these older commoditized products. So those are just a couple, like, you know, we have Medicaid policies that are penalizing generic manufacturers when they do not take a price increase. They're penalizing them for actions taken by competitors. We have to fix these policies and have a if we have a healthier market, that will also help solve these shortage issues.
And that was a great way to tie it all together in some ways. We've talked a lot of common themes, a lot of great synergies amongst the trading partners in the supply chain. And I don't know if everybody fully appreciates how much in common and alignment you all do have. I know there's some differences, but there's a lot of common themes. And I think we really hit on some good, maybe Craig, to your point, like there's some shorter term, right? Solutions that are a little bit more low hanging fruit. And then there's that bigger picture in terms of what can we do policy wise, federal payment wise, market wise, that would really have that longer term sustainability that we need to ensure that we've got the availability of drugs when we need them. So I'm going to say thank you to all of you because that was an incredible discussion. I appreciate your time, appreciate everybody's time in joining us. And that does bring us to the end of this month's Northern Virginia Health Policy Forum. Thank you, Craig, Nicolette, and Tom, for sharing your incredible knowledge and expertise with us. We could absolutely keep talking for hours, but we won't do that. Maybe we'll have to do a part two at some point in the future. Thank you again for all of your time. Thanks to the audience for joining us, and have a wonderful rest of your day.
This has been a Northern Virginia Health Policy Forum presentation, sponsored by Applied Policy in Alexandria, Virginia. For more from this discussion, please go to novahealthpolicy.com. Thank you for listening.